Chapter 53. The Price of a Departure. Only three candles and two lamps lit the common room of the wine spring inn, since candles and oil both were in short supply. The spears and other weapons were gone from the walls. The barrel that had held old swords was empty. The lamps stood on two of the tables pushed together in front of the tall stone fireplace, where Maren Alvir and Daes Conger and others of the women's circle were going over lists of the scanty food remaining in Emmons Field. Perrin tried not to listen. At another table, Fael's honing stone made a soft, steady whisk-whisk as she sharpened one of her knives. A bow lay in front of her, and a bristling quiver hung at her belt. She had turned out to be a fairly good shot, but he hoped she never discovered that it was a boy's bow. She could not draw a man's Two Rivers longbow, though she refused to admit it. Shifting his axe so it would not dig into his side, he tried to put his mind back on what he was discussing with the men around the table with him. Not that all of them were keeping their own attention where it should be.
"They have lamps," Sen muttered, "and we make do with tallow."
The gnarled old man glared at the pair of candles in brass candlesticks.
"Give over, Sen," Tam said wearily, pulling pipe and tobacco pouch from behind his sword belt. "For once, give over."
"If we had to read or write," Abel said, his voice less patient than the words, "we'd have lamps."
A bandage was wound around his temples. As if to remind the Thatcher that he was mayor, Bran adjusted the silver medallion hanging on his wide chest, showing a pair of scales.
"Keep your mind to the business at hand, Sin. I'll have none of your wasting parents' time."
"I just think we should have lamps," Sen complained. "Perrin would tell me if I was wasting his time."
Perrin sighed. The knight tried to drag his eyelids down. He wished it were someone else's turn to represent the village council, Harl Luhan, or John Thane, or Samuel Craw, or anybody but Sen with his carping. But then sometimes he wished one of these men would turn to him and say, "This is business for the mayor and the council, young fellow. You go on back to the forge. We'll let you know what to do." Instead, they worried about wasting his time, deferred to him. Time. How many attacks had there been in the 7 days since the first? He was not sure any longer. The bandage on Abel's head irritated Perrin. The Aes Sedai only healed the most serious wounds now. If a man could manage without, they let him. It was not that there were many badly wounded yet, but as Varen pointed out wryly, even an Aes Sedai only had so much strength. Apparently, their trick with the catapult stones took as much as healing. For once, he did not want to be reminded of limits to Aes Sedai strength. Not many badly wounded. Yet. "How are the arrows holding out?" he asked. That was what he was supposed to be thinking about.
"Well enough," Tam said, puffing his pipe alight from one of the candles. "We still recover most of what we shoot, in daylight at least. They drag a lot of their dead away at night. Fodder for the cookpots, I suppose, and we lose those."
The other men were digging out their pipes too, from pouches and coat pockets. Sen muttering that he seemed to have forgotten his pouch. Grumbling, Bran passed his across, his bald pate gleaming in the candlelight. Perrin rubbed at his forehead. What had he meant to ask next? The stakes. There was fighting at the stakes in most attacks now, especially at night. How many times had the Trollocs nearly broken through? 3? 4? "Does anybody have a spear or some sort of pole arm now? What's left to make more?" Silence answered him, and he lowered his hand. The other men were staring at him.
"You asked that yesterday," Abel said gently, "and Harl told you then there isn't a scythe or a pitchfork left in the village that hasn't been made into a weapon. We've more than we have hands for, in truth."
"Yes, of course. It just slipped my mind."
A snatch of conversation from the women's circle caught his ear.
"Mustn't let the men know," Maren was saying softly, as if repeating a caution voiced before.
"Of course not,"
Daes snorted, but not much louder.
If the fools find out the women are on half rations, they'll insist on eating the same. And we can't...
Perrin closed his eyes, tried to close his ears. Of course. The men did the fighting. The men had to keep their strength up. Simple. At least none of the women had had to fight yet. Except the two Aiel women, of course, and Fael. But she was smart enough to stay back when it came to pushing spears among the stakes. That was the reason he had found the bow for her. She had the heart of a leopard, and more courage than any two men.
I think it is time you went to bed, Perrin, Bran suggested. You cannot go on like this, sleeping an hour here and an hour there.
Scrubbing his beard vigorously, Perrin tried to look alert.
I'll sleep later,
when it was over.
Are the men getting enough sleep? I've seen some sitting up when they should be.
The front door banged open to admit skinny Danil Lewin out of the night, bow in hand, and all in a lather. He wore one of the swords from the barrel on his hip. Tam had been giving classes when he had the time, and sometimes one of the warders did as well. Before Danil could open his mouth, Day snapped,
Were you raised in a barn, Danil Lewin?
You can certainly treat my door a little more gently.
Maren divided her meaning look between the lanky man and Day's, a reminder that it was her door. Danil ducked his head, clearing his throat.
Pardon, Mr. Salvier, he said hastily. Pardon, Wisdom. Sorry to burst in, but I've a message for Perrin.
He hurried to the table of men, as if afraid the women would stop him again.
The White Cloaks brought in a man who wants to talk to you, Perrin. He won't talk to anybody else. He's hurt bad, Perrin. They only brought him to the edge of the village. I don't think he can make it as far as the inn.
Perrin pushed himself to his feet.
I'm coming.
Not another attack, at any rate. They were worst at night. Fael snatched up her bow and joined him before he reached the door, and Aram stood up, hesitating from the shadows on the foot of the stairs. Sometimes Perrin forgot the man was there, he kept so still. He looked odd with that sword strapped on his back atop his grimy, yellow-striped tinker coat, his eyes so bright, hardly ever seeming to blink, and his face without expression. Neither Rain or Isla had spoken to their grandson since the day he picked up that sword. Nor to Perrin, either.
If you're coming, come, he said gruffly,
and Aram fell in at his heels. The man followed him like a hound whenever he was not pestering Tam or Ivan or Tomas to teach him that sword. It was as if he had replaced his family and people with Perrin. Perrin would have done without the responsibility if he could, but there it was. Moonlight shone down on thatched roofs. Few houses had a light in more than one window. Stillness clung to the village. Some 30 of the companions stood guard outside the inn with their bows, as many wearing swords as could find them. Everyone had adopted that name, and Perrin found himself using it too, to his private disgust. The reason for guards on the inn, or wherever Perrin was, lay on the green, no longer so crowded with sheep and cows. Campfires crowded above the wine spring, beyond where that fool wolfhead banner hung limp now. Bright pools in the darkness, surrounded by pale cloaks gleaming with the moon. No one had wanted white cloaks in their homes, already crowded, and Bornhall did not want his soldiers split up in any case. The man seemed to think the village would turn on him and his men any moment. If they followed Perrin, they must be dark friends. Even Perrin's eyes could not make out faces around the fires. But he thought he could feel Bornhald's stare, waiting, hating. Danil readied 10 companions to escort Perrin, all young men who should have been laughing and carousing with him, all with bows ready to see him safe. Aram did not join them as Danil led the way down the dark dirt street. It was Perrin he was with, and no one else. Fael kept hard by Perrin's side, dark eyes shining in the moonlight, scanning the surroundings as though she were his whole protection. Where the old road entered Emmons Field, the blocking wagons had been drawn aside to admit the White Cloak patrol, 20 snow-cloaked men with lances who sat their horses in burnished armor, no less impatient than their stamping mounts. They stood out in the night for any eye, and most Trollocs could see as well in darkness as Perrin. But the White Cloaks insisted on their patrols. Sometimes their scouting had brought warnings, and maybe their harassment kept the Trollocs a little off balance. It would have been good, though, if he had known what they were doing before it was done. A cluster of villagers and farmers wearing bits of old armor and a few rusty helmets stood clustered around a man in a farmer's coat lying in the roadway. They gave way for Fael and him, and he went to one knee beside the man. The odor of blood was strong. Sweat glistened on the man's moon-shadowed face. A thumb-thick Trolloc arrow, like a small spear, was stuck through his chest.
"Perrin, Golden Eyes,"
he muttered hoarsely, laboring for breath.
"Must get through to Perrin, Golden Eyes."
"Has someone sent for one of the Aes Sedai?" Perrin demanded, lifting the man as gently as he could, cradling his head. He did not listen for the answer. He did not think this man would last till an Aes Sedai came.
"I am Perrin. Golden Eyes, I cannot see very well."
His wide, wild stare was right at Perrin's face. If he could see at all, the fellow must see his eyes shining golden in the dark.
"I am Perrin Golden Eyes," he said reluctantly.
The man seized his collar, pulling his face close with surprising strength.
"We are coming, sent to tell you, we are
His head fell back, eyes staring at nothing now.
"The light be with his soul,"
Fael murmured, slinging her bow across her back. After a moment, Perrin pried the man's fingers loose.
"Does anyone know him?"
The Two Rivers men exchanged glances, shook their heads. Perrin looked up at the mounted White Cloaks.
"Did he say anything else while you were bringing him in? Where did you find him?"
Jarrett Beyer stared down at him, gaunt-faced and hollow-eyed, an image of death. The other White Cloaks looked away, but Beyer always made himself meet Perrin's yellow eyes, especially at night when they glowed. Beyer growled under his breath. Perrin heard shadows spawn, and booted his horse in the ribs. The patrol galloped into the village, as eager to be away from Perrin as from Trollocs. Aram stared after them, expressionless, one hand over his shoulder to finger his sword hilt.
"They said they found him 3 or 4 miles south."
Dennell hesitated, then added,
"They say the Trollocs are all scattered out in little bunches, Perrin. Maybe they're finally giving up."
Perrin laid the stranger back down.
"We are coming.
Keep a close watch. Maybe some family who tried to hold on to their farm is finally coming in."
He did not believe anyone could have survived out there this long, but it might be so.
"Don't shoot anybody by mistake."
He staggered to his feet, and Fael put a hand on his arm.
"It is time you were in bed, Perrin. You have to sleep sometime."
He only looked at her. He should have made her stay in Tyr. Somehow he should have made her. If he had only thought well enough, he could have. One of the runners, a curly-haired boy about chest high, slipped through the Two Rivers men to tug at Perrin's sleeve. Perrin did not know him. There were many families in from the countryside.
"There's something moving in the Westwood, Lord Perrin. They sent me to tell you."
"Don't call me that,"
Perrin told him sharply. If he did not stop the children, the companions are going to start using it too.
"Go tell them I will be there."
The boy darted away.
"You belong in your bed," Fael said firmly. "Tomas can handle any attack very well."
"It isn't an attack, or the boy would have said so, and somebody would be sounding Sen's bugle." She hung onto his arm, trying to pull him toward the inn, and so she was dragged along when he started the opposite way. After a few futile minutes, she gave up and pretended she had been merely holding his arm all along. But she muttered to herself. She still seemed to think that if she spoke softly enough, he could not hear. She began with foolish, mule-headed, and muscle-brained. After that, it escalated. It was quite a little procession, her muttering at him, Aram healing him, Dan'l and the 10 companions surrounding him like a guard of honor. If he had not been so tired, he would have felt a proper fool. There were guards spaced in small clusters all along the sharp stake fence to watch the night, each with a boy for a runner. At the west end of the village, the men on guard were all gathered up against the inside of the broad barrier, fingering spears and bows as they peered toward the westward. Even with the moonlight, the trees had to be blackness in their eyes. Tomas's cloak seemed to make parts of him vanish in the night. Bane and Chiad were with him. For some reason, the two maidens had spent every night at this end of Emmons Field since Loyal and Gaul left.
"I'd not have bothered you," the warder said to Perrin, "but there only seems to be one out there, and I thought you might be able to..."
Perrin nodded. Everyone knew about his vision, especially in darkness. The Two Rivers people seemed to think it something special, something that marked him out an idiot hero. What the warders thought, or the Aes Sedai, he had no idea. He was too tired to care tonight. 7 days, and how many attacks? The edge of the westwood lay 500 paces away. Even to his eyes, the trees ran together in shadows. Something moved. Something big enough to be a trolloc. A big shape carrying... The burden lifted an arm. A human. A tall shadow carrying a human.
"We will not shoot!"
he shouted. He wanted to laugh. In fact, he realized he was laughing.
"Come on! Come on, Loyal!"
The dim shape lumbered forward faster than a man could run, resolving into the Ogier, speeding toward the village carrying Gaul. Two Rivers men shouted encouragement as if it were a race.
"Run, Ogier! Run! Run!"
Perhaps it was a race. More than one assault had come out of those woods. Short of the stakes, Loyal slowed with a lurch. There was barely room for his thick legs to edge through the barrier sideways. Once on the village side, he let the Aielman down and sank to the ground, leaning back against the hedge, panting, tufted ears drooping wearily. Gaul limped on one leg until he could sit too, with Bane and Chiad both fussing over his left thigh, where his breeches were ripped and black with dry blood. He only had two spears left, and his quiver gaped emptily. Loyal's axe was gone, too.
"You fool, Ogier," Perrin laughed fondly. "Going off like that? I ought to let Daes Conger switch you for a runaway. At least you're alive. At least you're back."
His voice sank at that. Alive. And back in Emmons Field.
"We did it, Perrin,"
Loyal panted, a tired drum-like boom.
4 days ago, we closed the way gate. It will take the elders or an Aes Sedai to open it again."
"He carried me most of the way from the mountains," Gaul said. "The Night Runner and perhaps 50 Trollocs chased us the first 3 days, but Loyal outran them."
He was trying to push the maidens away without much success.
"Lie still, Sharad," Chiad snapped, "or I will say I have touched you armed and allowed you to choose how your honor stands."
Fayil gave a delighted laugh. Perrin did not understand, but the remark reduced the imperturbable Aielman to splutters. He let the maidens tend his leg.
"Are you all right, Loyal?" Perrin asked. "Are you hurt?"
The Ogier pulled himself up with an obvious effort, swaying for a moment like a tree about to fall. His ears still hung limp.
"No, I am not hurt, Perrin. Only tired. Do not worry yourself about me. A long time out of the steading. Visits are not enough."
He shook his head as if his thoughts had wandered. His wide hand engulfed Perrin's shoulder.
"I will be fine after a little sleep."
He lowered his voice. For an Ogier, he did. It was still a huge bumblebee rumble.
"It is very bad out there, Perrin. We followed the last bands down, for the most part. We locked the gate. But I think there must be several thousand Trollocs in the Two Rivers already, and maybe as many as 50 Myrdral."
"Not so,"
Luke announced loudly. He had galloped up along the edge of the houses from the direction of the north road. He reined his rearing black stallion to a flashy halt, four hooves pawing.
You are no doubt fine at singing to trees, Ogier, but fighting Trollocs is something different. I estimate less than 1,000 now. A formidable force, to be sure, but nothing these stout defenses and brave men cannot hold at bay. Another trophy for you, Lord Perrin Golden Eyes.
Laughing, he tossed a bulging cloth bag at Perrin. The bottom gleamed darkly wet in the moonlight. Perrin caught it out of the air and hurled it well over the stakes despite its weight. 4 or 5 Trolloc heads, no doubt, and perhaps a Murdrawl. The man brought in his trophies every night, still seeming to expect them to be put up for everyone to admire. A bunch of the Coplins and Congers had given him a feast the night he came in with a pair of Fade's heads.
"Do I also know nothing of fighting?" Gaul demanded, struggling to his feet. "I say there are several 1,000.
Luke's teeth showed white in a smile.
"How many days have you spent in the Blight, Aiel?" "I have spent many."
Perhaps it was more snarl than smile.
"Many. Believe what you wish, Golden Eyes. The endless days will bring what they bring, as they always have."
He pulled the stallion up on its hind legs again to whirl about, and galloped in among the houses and the trees that had once been the rim of the Westwood. The Two Rivers men shifted uneasily, peering after him or out into the night.
"He is wrong," Loyal said. "Gaul and I saw what we saw."
His face sagged wearily, broad mouth turned down and long eyebrows drooping on his cheeks. No wonder if he had carried Gaul for 3 or 4 days.
"You have done a lot, Loyal," Perrin said. "You and Gaul both. A great thing. I am afraid your bedroom has 6 tinkers in it now, but Mistress Alvir will make you up a pallet. It is time for you to get some of that sleep you want." "And time for you as well, Perrin Ebarra."
Scudding clouds made moonshadows play across Fael's bold nose and high cheekbones. She was so beautiful, but her voice was firm enough for a wagon bed.
"If you do not go now, I will have Loyal carry you. You can hardly stand."
Gaul was having trouble walking with his wounded leg. Bane supported him from one side. He tried to stop Chiad from taking the other, but she murmured something that sounded like Guy Shine in a threatening way, and Bane laughed, and the Aielman allowed them both to help him, growling furiously to himself. Whatever the maidens were going on about, it did have Gaul in a taking. Tomas clapped Perrin on the shoulder.
"Go, man. Everyone needs to sleep."
He himself sounded good for 3 more days without it. Perrin nodded. He let Fael guide him back to the Wine Spring Inn with Loyal and the Aiel following, and Aram and Danil and the 10 companions encircling him. He was not sure when the others fell away, but somehow he and Fael were alone in his room on the 2nd floor of the inn.
"Whole families are making do with no more space than this," he muttered.
A candle burned on the stone mantel over the small fireplace. Others did without, but Marin lit one here as soon as it turned dark, so he would not have to be bothered.
"I can sleep outside with Danil and Ban and the others."
"Do not be an idiot," Fael said, making it sound affectionate. "If Alana and Varen each has her own room, you should too."
He realized she had his coat off and was untying the laces of his shirt.
"I am not too tired to undress myself."
He pushed her gently outside.
"You take everything off," she ordered. "Everything, do you hear? You cannot sleep properly fully dressed, the way you seem to think."
"I will," he promised.
When he had the door closed, he did tug off his boots before blowing out the candle and lying down. Marn would not like dirty boots on her coverlet.
1,000s, Gaul and Loyal said.
Yet how much could the two of them have seen? Hiding on the way into the mountains, fleeing on the way back? Maybe 1,000 at most, Luke claimed, but Perrin could not make himself trust the man for all the trophies he brought in.
Scattered, according to the White Cloaks. How close could they have come, armor and cloaks shining in the darkness like lanterns?
There was a way to see for himself, perhaps. He had avoided the wolf dream since his last visit. The desire to hunt down this slayer rose up whenever he thought of going back, and his responsibilities lay here in Emmons Field. But now, perhaps... Sleep rolled in while he was still considering. He stood on the green, bathed by an afternoon sun low in the sky, a few white clouds drifting. There were no sheep or cattle around the tall pole where a breeze ruffled the red wolfhead banner, though a blue fly buzzed past his face. No people among the thatched houses. Small piles of dry wood atop ashes marked the White Cloak's fires. He had rarely seen anything burning in the wolf dream, only what was ready to burn or already charred. No ravens in the sky. As he scanned for the birds, a patch of sky darkened, became a window to somewhere else. Egwene stood among a crowd of women, fear in her eyes. Slowly the women knelt around her. Nynaeve was one of them, and he believed he saw Elaine's red-gold hair. That window faded and was replaced. Matt stood naked and bound, snarling. An odd spear with a black shaft had been thrust across his back behind his elbows, and a silver medallion, a fox head, hung on his chest. Matt vanished, and it was Rand. Perrin thought it was Rand. He wore rags and a rough cloak, and a bandage covered his eyes. The third window disappeared. The sky was only sky, empty except for the clouds. Perrin shivered. These wolf dream visions never seemed to have any real connection to anything he knew. Maybe here, where things could change so easily, worry over his friends became something he could see. Whatever they were, he was wasting time fretting at them. He was not surprised to find he wore a blacksmith's long leather vest and no shirt, but when he put a hand to his belt, he found the hammer, not his axe. Frowning, he concentrated on the long half-moon blade and thick spike. That was what he needed now. That was what he was now. The hammer changed slowly, as if resisting. But when the axe finally hung in the thick loop, it kept shining dangerously. Why did it fight him so? He knew what he wanted. A filled quiver appeared on his other hip, a longbow in his hand, a leather bracer on his left forearm. Three land-blurring strides took him where the nearest Trolloc camp supposedly lay, 3 miles from the village. The last step landed him among nearly a dozen tall heaps of wood, laid on old ashes amid trampled-down barley, the logs mixed with broken chairs and table legs and even a farmhouse door. Great black iron cauldrons stood ready to be hung over the laid cook fires. Empty cauldrons, of course, though he knew what would be cut up into them, what would be spitted on the thick iron rods stretched over some of the fires. How many Trollocs would these fires serve? There were no tents, and the blankets scattered about, filthy and stinking of old acrid Trolloc sweat, were no real guide. Many Trollocs slept like animals, uncovered on the ground, even hollowing out a hole to lie in. In smaller steps that covered no more than 100 paces each, the land seemed only to haze. He circled Emmons Field from farm to farm, pasture to barley field to rows of tobacco, through scattered copses of trees, along cart paths and footpaths, finding more and more clusters of waiting Trolloc fires, as he slowly spiraled outward. Too many. Hundreds of fires. That had to mean several thousand Trollocs. 5,000 or 10, or twice that, it would make little difference to Emmons Field if they all came at once. Farther south, the signs of Trollocs vanished. Signs of their immediate presence, at least. Few farmhouses or barns stood unburned. Scattered fields of charred stubble remained where barley or tobacco had been torched. Others had great swaths trampled through the crops. No reason for it but the joy of destruction. The people had been long gone when most of it was done. Once he lighted in the midst of large patches of ash, some charred wagon wheels, still showing hints of bright color here and there.
The sight of the Tuathawan caravan's destruction pained him even more than the farmhouses. The Way of the Leaf should have a chance. Somewhere. Not here. Not letting himself look, he leaped south a mile or more. Eventually he came to Devon Ride, rows of thatched-roofed houses surrounding a green and a pond, fed by a spring walled round with stone, the spillover splashing from cuts long since worn deeper than they had been made. The inn at the head of the green, the Goose and Pipe, was roofed with thatch too, yet a little larger than the Winespring Inn, though Devon Ride surely had even fewer visitors than Emmons Field. The village was certainly no bigger. Wagons and carts drawn close by every house spoke of farmers who had fled here with their families. Other wagons blocked the streets and the spaces between the houses, all the way around the edge of the village. The precautions were not enough to have halted even one of the assaults made on Emmons Field the last 7 days. In 3 circuits around the village, Perrin found only 6 Trolloc camps. Enough to keep people in, pen them until Emmons Field was dealt with. Then the Trollocs could fall on Devon Ride at the Fade's leisure. Perhaps he could find a way to get word to these villagers. If they fled south, they might find some way across the White River. Even trying to cross the trackless forest of shadows below the river was better than waiting to die. The golden sun had not moved an inch. Time was different here. Running north as hard as he could, even Emmons Field passed by in a blur. Watch Hill, on its round prominence, was bordered as Devon Ride had been, with wagons and carts between the houses. A banner waved lazily in the breeze, on a tall pole in front of the White Boar on the hill's crest. A red eagle flying across a field of blue. The red eagle had been the symbol of Manetherin. Perhaps Alana or Varen had told ancient stories while they were in Watch Hill. Here, too, he found only a few Trolloc camps, enough to pen the villagers. There was an easier way out from here than trying to cross the White, with its endless stretch of rapids. On northward he ran to Tarin Ferry, on the bank of the Tarindrell, which he had grown up calling the River Tarin. Tall, narrow houses built on high stone foundations to escape the Tarin's yearly flooding when the snows melted in the mountains of mist. Nearly half those foundations supported only piles of ash and charred beams in that unchanging afternoon light. There were no wagons here, no signs of any defense, and no Trolloc camps that he could find. Perhaps no people remained here. At the water's edge stood a stout wooden dock, a heavy rope drooping as it arced across the swift-flowing river. The rope ran through iron rings on a flat-decked barge, snugged against the dock. The ferry was still there, still usable. A jump took him across the river, where wheel ruts scarred the bank and household objects lay about. Chairs and stand mirrors, chests, even a few tables and a polished wardrobe with birds carved on the doors, all the things panicked people had tried to save, then abandoned to run faster. They would be spreading the word of what had happened here, what was happening in the two rivers. Some could have reached Bearlon by now, 100 miles or more north, and surely the farms and villages between Bearlon and the river. Word spreading. In another month it might reach Camelin, and Queen Morgaze with her queen's guards and her power to raise armies. A month with luck. And as much to return once Morgaze believed. Too late for Emmons Field. Maybe too late for the whole two rivers. Still, it hardly made sense that the Trollocs had let anyone escape. Or the Murdrell, at any rate. Trollocs did not seem to think much beyond the moment. He would have thought destroying the ferry would have been the Fade's first task. How could they be sure there were not enough soldiers at Bearlon to come down on them? He bent to pick up a doll with a painted wooden face, and an arrow streaked through where his chest had been. Springing out of his crouch, he leaped up the bank, a blur streaking 100 paces into the woods to crouch below a tall leather leaf. Brush and flood-toppled trees, woven with creepers, covered the forest floor around him. Slayer.
Perrin had an arrow knocked and wondered if he had drawn it from his quiver or simply thought it there. Slayer. On the point of leaping away again, he paused. Slayer would know roughly where he was. Perrin had followed the man's blurring form easily enough. That elongated streak was clear if he were standing still. Twice now he had played the other's game and nearly lost. Let Slayer play his this time. He waited. Ravens swooped above the treetops, searching and calling. No movement to give him away, not a twitch. Only his eyes moved, studying the forest around him. A vagrant puff of air brought him a cold smell, human yet not, and he smiled. No sound save the ravens, though. This slayer stalked well. But he was not used to being hunted. What else did Slayer forget besides smells? He surely would not expect Perrin to remain where he had landed. Animals ran from the hunter. Even wolves ran. A hint of movement, and for an instant a face appeared above a fallen pine some 50 paces away. The slanting light illuminated it clearly. Dark hair and blue eyes, a face all hard planes and angles, so reminiscent of Lan's face. Except that in that brief glimpse, Slayer licked his lips twice. His forehead was creased and his eyes darted as they searched. Lan would not have let his worry show if he stood alone against 1,000 Trollocs. Just an instant and the face was gone again. The ravens darted and swirled above as if they shared Slayer's anxiety, fearing to come below the treetops. Perrin waited and watched, motionless. Silence. Only the cold smell to say he was not alone with the ravens overhead. Slayer's face appeared again, peering around a thick bold oak off to his left. 30 paces. Oaks killed most of what grew close to them. Only a few mushrooms and weedy things sprouted from the leafy mulch beneath its limbs. Slowly the man emerged into the open, boots making no sound. In one motion, Perrin drew and fired. The ravens screamed warning, and Slayer spun to take the broadhead shaft in his chest, but not through the heart. The man howled, clutching the arrow with both hands. Black feathers rained down as the ravens beat their wings in a frenzy. And Slayer faded. Him and his cry together, growing misty, transparent, vanishing. The raven's shrieks vanished as if severed with a knife. The arrow that had transfixed the man dropped to the ground. The ravens were gone too. With a second shaft half drawn, Perrin exhaled slowly, let off his tension on the bowstring. Was that how you died here? Simply fading away, gone forever? At least I finished him, he muttered, and let himself be diverted in the process. Slayer was no part of why he had come to the wolf dream. At least the wolves were safe now. The wolves, and maybe a few others. He stepped out of the dream and woke, staring at the ceiling, his shirt clinging sweatily. The moon gave a little light through the windows. There were fiddles playing somewhere in the village, a wild tinker tune. They would not fight, but they had found a way to help by keeping spirits up. Slowly, Perrin sat up, pulling on his boots in the pale-lit dark. How to do what he had to do? It would be difficult. He had to be cunning. Only he was not sure he had ever been cunning in his life. Standing, he stamped his feet to settle them in. Suddenly, shouts outside and a fading clatter of hooves made him stride to the nearest window and throw up the sash. The companions were milling about below. What's going on down there? 30 faces turned up to him, and Ban Alcine yelled, It was Lord Luke, Lord Perrin. He nearly rode down Will and Tell. I don't think he even saw them. He was all hunched over in his saddle like he was hurt, and spurring that stallion for all he was worth, Lord Perrin. Perrin tugged at his beard. Luke had certainly not been wounded earlier. Luke and Slayer? It was impossible. Dark-haired Slayer looked like Lan's brother or cousin. If Luke, with his red-gold hair, resembled anyone, maybe it was Rand a little. The two men could not have been more dissimilar. And yet, that cold smell. They did not smell the same, but both had an icy, hardly human scent. His ears picked up the sound of wagons being hauled out of the way down at the old road, shouts for haste. Even if Ban and the companions ran, they would not catch the man now. Hooves galloped south hard.
"Ban," he called. "If Luke shows up again, he's to be put under guard and kept there."
He paused long enough to add,
"And don't call me that,"
before hauling the sash down with a bang. Luke and Slayer. Slayer and Luke. How could they be the same?
It was impossible.
But then, less than 2 years gone, he had not really believed in Trollocs or Fades. Time enough to worry about it, if he ever laid hands on the man again. Now there was Watch Hill and Devon Ride, and some could be saved. Not everyone in the Two Rivers had to die. On his way to the common room, he paused at the top of the stairs. Aram stood up from the bottom step, watching him, waiting to follow where he led. Gaul lay stretched out on a pallet near the fireplace with a bandage thick around his left thigh, apparently asleep. Fael and the two maidens sat cross-legged on the floor near him, talking softly. A much larger pallet lay on the far side of the room, but Loyal sat on a bench with his legs stretched out so they would fit under one of the tables, nearly doubled over so he could scribble furiously with a pen by the light of a candle. No doubt he was recording what had happened on the journey to close the waygate. And if Perrin knew Loyal at all, the Ogier would have Gaul doing it all, whether he had or not. Loyal did not seem to think anything he himself did was brave or worth writing down. Except for them, the common room was empty. He could still hear those fiddles playing. He thought he recognized the tune. Not a tinker song now. My love is a wild rose. Fael looked up at Perrin's first step down, rising gracefully to meet him. Aram took his seat again when Perrin made no move toward the door.
"Your shirt is wet," Fael said accusingly. "You slept in it, didn't you? And your boots, I shouldn't wonder. It has not been an hour since I left you. You march yourself back upstairs before you fall down."
"Did you see Luke leave?" he said. Her mouth tightened, but sometimes ignoring her was the only way. She managed to win too often when he argued with her.
"He came running through here a few minutes ago and dashed out through the kitchen," she said finally.
Those were the words. Her tone said she was not finished with him in bed. "Did he seem to be injured?"
"Yes," she said slowly. "He staggered, and he was clutching something to his chest under his coat. A bandage, maybe. Mistress Conger is in the kitchen, but from what I heard, he all but ran over her." "How did you know?"
"I dreamed it." Her tilted eyes took on a dangerous light. She must not be thinking. She knew about the wolf dream. Did she expect him to explain where Bane and Chiad could hear, not to mention Aram and Loyal? Well, maybe not Loyal. He was so absorbed in his notes he would not have noticed a flock of sheep herded into the common room. "Gaul?"
"Mistress Conger gave him something to make him sleep and a poultice for his leg. When the Aes Sedai wake in the morning, one of them will heal him, if they think it serious enough."
"Come sit down, Fael. I want you to do something for me." She eyed him suspiciously, but let him lead her to a chair. When they were seated, he leaned across the table, trying to make his voice serious but not urgent. On no account urgent. "I want you to take a message to Camelin for me. On the way, you can let Watch Hill know how things are here. Actually, it might be best if they cross the tarn until it's all done."
That had sounded properly casual, just a bit thrown in on the spur of the moment.
"I want you to ask Queen Morgaise to send us some of the Queen's guards. I know it's a dangerous thing I'm asking, but Bane and Chiad can get you to Tarn Ferry safely, and the ferry is still there."
Chiad stood up,
staring at him anxiously. Why was she anxious?
You will not have to leave him, Fael told her.
After a moment, the Aiel woman nodded and resumed her seat beside Gaul.
Chiad and Gaul? They were blood enemies.
Nothing was making sense tonight.
It is a long way to Camelin,
Fael went on quietly. Her eyes very intent on his, but her face could have been wood for all the expression it had.
Weeks to ride there, plus however long it might take to reach and convince Morghese, then more weeks to return with the Queen's guards.
We can hold out that long easily, he told her. Burn me if I can't lie as well as Matt. Luke was right. There can't be more than 1,000 Trollocs still out there.
The dream?
She nodded. At last she understood. We can hold out here for a very long time. But in the meanwhile, they'll be burning crops and doing the like knows what. We'll need the Queen's guards to rid ourselves of them completely. You are the logical one to go. You know how to talk to a queen, being a queen's cousin and all. Fael, I know what I'm asking is dangerous.
Not as dangerous as staying.
But once you reach the ferry, you'll be on your way. He did not hear Loyal approach until the Ogier laid his book of notes down in front of Fael.
I could not help overhearing, Fael. If you are going to Camelin, would you carry this? To keep it safe until I can come for it?
Scurrying the volume up, almost tenderly, he added,
They print many very fine books in Camelin. Forgive me for interrupting, Baron.
But his teacup eyes were on her, not him.
Fael suits you. You should fly free, like a falcon.
Patting Perrin on the shoulder, he murmured in a deep rumble,
She should fly free.
Then made his way to his pallet and lay down facing the wall.
He is very tired, Perrin said, attempting to make it seem just a comment.
The fool Ogier could ruin everything. If you leave tonight, you can be at Watch Hill by daybreak. You'll have to swing to the east. The Trollocs are fewer there. This is very important to me. To Emmons Field, I mean. Will you do it?
She stared at him silently for so long he wondered if she meant to answer. Her eyes seemed to glisten. Then she got up and sat down on his lap, stroking his beard.
This needs trimming. I like it on you. But I do not want it down to your chest.
He came close to gaping.
She often changed the subject on him, but usually when she was losing an argument.
Fael, please, I need you to carry this message to Camelin.
Her hand tightened in his beard, and her head swung as if she were arguing with herself inside her head.
I will go, she said at last, but I want a price. You always make me do things the hard way. In Saldaea, I would not have to be the one who asked. My price is a wedding. I want to marry you,
she finished up in a rush.
And I you.
He smiled. We can say the betrothal vows in front of the women's circle tonight, but I'm afraid the wedding has to wait a year. When you come back from Camelin,
she very nearly yanked a handful of beard out of his chin. I will have you for husband tonight, she said in fierce low tones, or I will not go until I do.
If there was any way, I would, he protested. Dae's conger would crack my head if I wanted to go against custom. For the love of the light, Fael, just carry the message, and I'll wed you the very first day I can.
He would, if that day ever came.
Suddenly, she was very intent on his beard, smoothing it and not meeting his eyes. She started speaking slowly, but picked up speed like a runaway horse.
I just happened to mention, in passing, I just mentioned to Mistress Alvere how we had been traveling together. I don't know how it came up. And she said, and Mistress Conger agreed with her, not that I talked to everybody. She said that we probably, certainly could be considered betrothed already under your customs, and the year is just to make sure you really do get on well together, which we do, as anyone can see. And here I am being as forward as some Domani hussy or one of those tyrant Gauls. If you ever even think of Berylaine... Oh, Light, I'm babbling, and you won't even...
He cut her off by kissing her as thoroughly as he knew how.
"Will you marry me?" he said breathlessly when he was done. "Tonight."
He must have done even better with the kiss than he thought. He had to repeat himself 6 times, with her giggling against his throat and demanding he say it again before she seemed to understand. Which was how he found himself, not half an hour later, kneeling opposite her in the common room, in front of Daes Conger and Maren Alvir, Alsbet Luhan and Nisa Ayelen, and all the women's circle. Loyal had been roused to stand for him, with Aram, and Bane and Chiad stood for Fail. There were no flowers to put in her hair, or his, but Bane, guided by Maren, tucked a long red wedding ribbon around his neck, and Loyal threaded another through Fail's dark hair, his thick fingers surprisingly deft and gentle. Perrin's hands trembled as he cupped hers.
"I, Perrin Ebarra, do pledge you my love, Fail Bashir, for as long as I live. For as long as I live and after. What I possess in this world, I give to you. A horse, an axe, a bow, a hammer. Not much to gift a bride. I give you my life, my love. It's all I have. I will keep and hold you, succor and tend you, protect and shelter you for all the days of my life. I can't keep you. The only way I can protect you is to send you away. I am yours, always and forever."
By the time he finished, his hands were shaking visibly. Fail moved her hands to hold his.
"I, Zareen Bashir."
That was a surprise. She hated that name.
"Do pledge you my love, Perrin Ebarra."
Her hands never trembled at all.